All right, welcome back, Patrick, and to everyone who's joining us here in the second hour, redicemembers.com and redicecreations.com, our websites. Now, there are, at this stage then, Patrick, a lot of people aware of the NSA. It's, you know, being launched maybe, well, hopefully then into the mass consciousness in a different way with the PRISM scandal and Edward Snowden and everything else. And a lot of people are aware of some of the levels of the tactics that is going on. But the question is, how well played this is and what the goal is in terms of where the U.S. is going to head with this. Because, you know, just as you pointed out before, we know that there is colonization going on of other countries, the spreading of the corporate monopoly culture around the globe and everything else. How do you think that they are looking to transform the United States with all of this, if they even have this in mind, as things like, you know, WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden and now the practically the murder of Michael Hastings here, the Rolling Stones journalist who died in his car at the age of 33. It's just more and more of this. What do you think, Patrick?
Well, the first thing that was overlooked in the whole Edward Snowden story right from the beginning was that just about the same time when the White House was already having to divulge or admit NSA spying. If you remember the timing of the Snowden affair, so when Snowden affair came out, it sort of covered up three, four, or five scandals that were already happening with regards to the Obama administration in Washington D.C. And one of them is that the abilities given to the NSA were that they could take phone records and data and metadata from people in foreign countries, okay? Now, that's very significant, okay? And what that means is that any countries that are signed up to the program, and probably say Britain or Germany, France, you know, Spain, probably, and all the European countries and other U.S. compliant countries, whoever signed up to that program is not going to have a problem with it. They just have to open the door and let the U.S. in. Then the rest of the world, they don't even have to open the door. The U.S. will just barge in and take that data anyway, because it has eminent domain. It's already proven that. It's had eminent domain over everybody in the globe. So that's significant. And when you just take a few steps backwards here and look at this, if you were to put a global government into play at some point in the near future, first thing you would need is a global military, which they effectively have in NATO, okay?
Yeah.
The second thing you'll need is a global police force, which they have the embryonic parts of that in terms of Interpol and in terms of the cooperation between the U.S. police forces, Israeli police forces, and the federalization of definitely of the police in America with Homeland Security running all of the agencies below it is subservient to them. Now, you would also need that spying network, the digital spying network. You need that in place. You need those agreements in place so that there'll be a smooth transition when a global government body does come. All the programs are in place, and all you have to do is change the name on the door. Okay?
Yeah.
That's what I thought was the most significant when the Snowden affair broke, was that it covered up that foreign intelligence gathering ability by the NSA, and also it's the other thing is the embryonic structures of global government are already in place, and in most cases they just don't have real jobs to do yet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they are already in place. And if anybody thinks for a second that there is not a global governing structure or global governance already taking place all around the world today as we speak, then I would suggest that they wake up and take a look.
That's right.
A perfect example is the global financial control system. And in many ways, the fact that there's only a handful of state central banks left on this planet, one of them was Libya. It's not anymore, obviously. The other ones are Iran, Syria, possibly, I believe, Venezuela, but I might be mistaken, I'm not sure, and Cuba, North Korea, and, you know, that basically whoever's left in the axis of evil has got a state-run central bank. And, of course, these countries can make laws about what they have to comply with financially in international terms. So, the Moody's downgrading Hong Kong banks is one thing, okay, but every single country, nearly every single country, basically has to comply with U.S. demands, even Geneva to a degree, allowing them to look in, snoop into the bank accounts and see who's got their money where. So they're chasing tax exiles, as they're called. They're not chasing any of the big ones. They're chasing the sort of mid-range, mid to lower range ones.
They're checking out the competition again, the small little, the privateers, yeah, in that environment. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes that you go into foreign countries and they have compliance paperwork that must be filled out for foreigners to have bank accounts in different countries, Turkey or other, but not necessarily in Syria, not in Iran. Okay, mm-hmm. So basically, the moral of the story is there's nowhere you can go to hide yourself or your money without us being able to take our hands on it. Yeah, and what's allowed them to have these powers all over the globe? Essentially, we're talking about the financial mafia in New York and London and Dusseldorf. What's given them this power is the war on terror, quite simply.
Yeah, and this is a major overhaul just, obviously in the last 10 to 12 years here. And just to clarify that to people, you're talking about the IMF, Bank of International Settlements, even the Inter-Alpha group of banks, perhaps?
Yes, yes, all the major banks. So a country can't be completely independent. Look at Cyprus, what happened there. Cyprus resisted some of these measures in order to protect the privacy of their big account holders. And look what happened to Cyprus. They came in with a hammer and said, okay, well if you're not going to restructure in our favor, we're going to smash your economy to bits and you'll never be able to recover.
Yeah.
And not only that, we will take the money out of the accounts, steal it from your people and all your foreign investors.
That's right. And again, a lot of Russians, we're back to that connection again, had actually accounts in Cyprus. And it was interesting. I think, was it everyone over who had 10,000 euros or was it 100,000 that was going to take 10%? Or was it more, Patrick? Do you remember? Just take it straight off?
They just took it. I mean, there were people with small accounts. I'm talking about, a few thousand. Their money was frozen for up to 90 days. Some was taken out of the small accounts. It was a total mess.
Yeah.
Complete cluster gang. And for the big, some of the big depositors, they lost all of their money. And they were given back part of their money in bank shares, which were not worth anything. Or not worth anything yet. So it, total decimation of businesses who had accounts. Some businesses I spoke to when I was there when the collapse was happening, all their credit card machines, all that was frozen. They could only take cash from customers. They couldn't access their cash reserves for a long period of time because the bank didn't have it, and a lot of businesses have folded. And some of them are just hanging on, but they might not be around at the end of the summer.
What does this tell you, Patrick, about, not only the system, of course, but also people's awareness and what people should do to avoid this? Because ultimately, when we come to these banks, etc., to be in that position, we become the slave, if you will, willingly. There has to be different options. But even as we've talked about before, having cash is better than having it in some of these crooks banks where they can just take and freeze your assets, in a whim.
Definitely. Yeah. Cash is one way to protect yourself. The other way is, You know, you have to make concerted moves in your life to try to shore up what you think are strong parts of your life, whether it be property or to consolidate with family and to avoid liabilities wherever you can, to avoid ways that you can be hamstrung easily. What can I say? There's a lot of things. You know, in America, the prepper movement, you know, get a generator, have diesel stocked up just in case, because when they cut the power, that's when all hell breaks loose, basically.
Yeah.
Grow your own food. That's a big one. That's a really interesting thing that I've noticed here in Lebanon, is that they don't have preppers here. Everybody's already prepped up.
Yeah, that's funny.
Because of the history of the country, everyone's just prepped up. Everyone's got, you know, generators. There's rolling power cuts, so they have to adapt. They have to have some generators, and they grow their own food. And they, you know, the in these countries like Lebanon and Syria, and some of the other small countries, and I'm sure in Africa, in many places in South America, the little man is still king. So the mom and pop shop on the corner is still king, and they're paying the same rent they paid 20 years ago. Okay,
yeah.
That's why they're still there.
Yeah.
Because the banks haven't taken over these societies to the same degree that they routed every European country in North America.
Yeah.
To the point where you can't afford to open a business on a high street. Okay, the little man is still king here, and the little man is able to sell to his neighborhood, and he has his constituents and his customer base that the big man can't take away, because they haven't been in to colonize with the supermarkets. And not only that, I'm talking about every single business and service you can imagine. Little man is king. Okay.
Yeah.
There's Pizza Huts here. They do delivery. There's McDonald's. Burger King does delivery here. You know, Arabs love things delivered to their door. But the majority of the trade is not coming from, they're not getting the majority of the trade. The majority of the trade is being gotten by the small food producers, the little cafes, the little kebab shops, the people that can basically deliver to their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they have a personal relationship with all their customers. And that does not exist in London, you know, in where I live in London. It does not exist anymore. It's gone.
Yeah.
The only people who can afford to open a business in that country are national chains. The same in America. Most of the business is done around strip malls. And the only people who can afford is a national chain where the poorly performing franchises or outlets are subsidized by the high performing ones on a nationwide basis.
That's right.
So that's part of this globalist revolution, and that's one of the reasons why there is a desire by the banks in the West to reform Syria. When they say reform, they mean reform it, change the form of it.
That's right.
That's what they really mean when they say reform. They want to reform Egypt. Egypt, the little man is king in Cairo. It's a huge city, and the little man rules the neighborhoods.
They want to get people there, as they've done in other parts of the world, the Western world, dependent on the structure, the monopoly, and the way as well in the supermarket, basically that whole the way that things are laid out. But as you said, if anything fails in that very delicate chain, you know, things could go. You know, it was like what, 2 days away from a, you know, bloody revolution. If food wasn't there, or if something fails in this supply chain, basically.
Sure. And in America, it's about, it's probably 2-4 days, 5 days. But here, I've been where society has been slightly shut down for short periods of time, but everyone can survive here because the local traders and the local resources are active, you know, and the chains are very complex, but they have to do with person to person to person. In America and Europe, it has to do with corporation to corporation to governments. That's how the supply chains are organized. And it's a totally different structure. And I dread to think what would happen if, let's say, the lorry drivers in the UK went on strike for a few days. They deliver all the food to every single place. So if there was a fuel crisis, for instance, and then they couldn't, or the prices were too high and they weren't getting paid, so they're not driving, or something like that, it's absolute pandemonium within a week. Okay, there'll be no bottled water on the shelf. There'll be no food, no produce, you name it. Okay, so everything will come to a grinding halt. That's the way. It's the centralized planning and how they've structured Europe and North America. It's so dependent on the centralization method. And so the big enemy of this new, what I'm going to call a one world order, it's not a new world order. That's right. Giving it too much credit. It's a one world order. In fact, it's more of the old world order, if anything.
Yeah.
And it has to do with centralization and dependency, programs of dependency and centralized distribution. And I'll give you a perfect example. You know, I spoke to one of the highest ranking U.S. Energy people about solar and wind, and they were still thinking that this was somehow viable in terms of erecting giant solar plants or giant wind farms to collect electricity and then to centrally distribute it. Okay, we all know it will happen with that model, which is that we'll pay more for our power and we'll get less of it. And the real revolution in solar, I met a student here in Beirut who was about 13 years old who built his own solar panel and could power his laptop computer and his mobile, his iPhones and everything on this. And that a 13-year-old just demonstrated where the real power in the green energy is. It's in the individual's ability to produce it for himself. And that's something that I just can't believe, that all the liberals and all the greenies and all the hippies can't get their head around. That is the crux of the problem. Once you have your own power source, you don't need this state. You then can heat your house. You then can grow your own garden. You know, yep. No one can kick you out, you know, unless it's a rent issue. But it's hugely liberating.
Yeah, if you become independent, you know, it would be truly I don't like to use the word revolution, but it would be a revelation to get this technology.
So this is, you know, again, back to that theme, you know, getting the poor middle-class people out of the city centers, rebuilding the cities with expensive properties, having it as a sort of playboy's playground, push the working classes out to tower blocks outside of the city and planned communities, isolated there and totally dependent on the state. That's what we see in Europe. That is their vision. A lot of people in central planning are really proud of that. Yeah. They think that that's just a fantastic achievement and progress. Of course, it's a nightmare if you've ever lived in those communities.
That's right.
Drug dealing, violence, stabbing, robbing. You know, I am in a city right now in a supposedly dangerous place in the world. It is dangerous in some ways, but if I leave my door unlocked and I leave for a day or two, nobody's going to come in and take anything in my flat. If I drop my wallet, I can go back to the same cafe a few hours later or maybe the next day and they'll have it at the cash register. Now, in the UK, if you don't have everything double locked or you turn your back and leave your bike outside of a shop when you go in to buy a loaf of bread, your bike will not be there when you come out. Okay?
Yeah.
You turn your back in a bar or a pub or anywhere, and you know your wallet will not be there. In fact, they'll even take your drink if you're not finished. You know, it's forced. This beautiful utopia of social engineering has forced a culture of thievery and stealing, and also class envy. And it's a horrible thing where people don't respect other people's property and they see it as an entitlement to take.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They don't have the same value system here in the Arab countries. Okay. Yes, there's corruption. Yes, there are white collar criminals and there are billionaires who are, you know, making the majority of the lion's share of the pie. But on the on the street level, people are not stealing from each other. And that's a big difference. It's a massive difference, and it changes your whole mindset on a day-to-day basis when you're here. And by that, I'm not looking forward to going back to Europe after being in the Middle East so long, because I know I have to be worried about keeping all my possessions totally secure all the time. Huh. And also I have to be ready to fight to keep them if I'm walking home at night.
Jeez, this system that was there to provide and also, you know, be egalitarian or equal or division from central point kind of thing has kind of caused a different kind of level of desperation, and it's turning people into kind of cornered animals almost a little bit. It's very interesting to see how the switch have happened when people previously had a, you know, you knew your neighbors kind of thing. And of course there's people that do this too. It's not, you know, cut like that in black and white, but generally, you know, you'd think that a society that got together to provide for each other, which is, you know, kind of an indirect way of, you know, how the Western world, or in Europe at least, they've chosen to do it under Keynesian economics and everything else, that, you know, they take from you and then they divide it equally among what they consider to be right. You know, I mean, that is hardly even been done anymore. But nonetheless, you think that environment, Patrick, would create a more, you know, kind of a camaraderie feeling, or like, yeah, we're in this together. We're helping each other out. It's you and me kind of thing. But it's the reverse has happened.
Yeah, resources are completely scarce. Human resources are scarce in the West. I'll give you an example. America is supposedly the wealthiest country in the world. That's a complete myth, by the way. But it is the most medicated country on the planet. Okay, more people are consuming more pharmaceutical products in the United States, more injections, more vaccinations, more pills, and they're also medicating themselves with other ways. You have alcohol, obviously, and other things, and, you know, illegal drugs. But it's the most and the comment you hear the most from Americans constantly, and the feeling you get from so many people, they're the America, when I travel through America, I love it. You know why? Because the people are so warm and the most friendly people on earth.
Yeah, but you're right.
But many of them are also the most lonely people, totally isolated. Okay, and this is by social engineering. And Europeans are isolated as well. And one of the reasons that people are isolated is because the state has managed to do something that it had been trying to do for a good part of 100 years, which is to break up the family unit.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Break up the relationships between family members. Now, if you look at Europe, look at Southern Europe, look at the difference between Southern Europe and Northern Europe. The family unit is more or less disintegrated in Northern Europe.
Yeah.
And the state plays the main role as the patriarch, or the matriarch is played by the state, the provider. Okay, and also gives you permission and gives you things and so forth. Now, in the South, the family is still the dominant paradigm, and they're working really hard to break the family. One of the ways they're doing this in Greece is to break the family by taking away the family home through new property taxes, for instance. So, in other words, the property is bought and paid for generations, but they could soon lose it. Why? Because they're behind on their property taxes, or they have to pay some new tax on the deed, or some new technocratic administrative phenomenon that's come into play. Yeah. And so you don't have refuge anymore. If times get tough, you can't go back to stay with the family. There is no family there. Mother is living in a one-bedroom council block outside of Naples, and there's no space there, and it's hell on earth, and so forth. You know, in the UK, the family is shunned upon in many ways. Parents are, and in America as well, it seemed through conditioning and media that you have to kick the children out at 18, or if they stay, they have to pay rent. Family paying rent in Italy or Greece or Spain, unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, but that's become they've corralled us like sheep, and we're also playing the part of the sheepdog as well, because we're policing ourselves in such a harsh way. Instead of saying, wow, actually, the family unit is should sit above the state. The family unit is the hardest thing for the state to crack. They can crack the political shell, they can crack a corporation, they can crack a city, they can even crack a neighborhood, but they can never crack the family. And they've managed to do that successfully. And now it's like there's a whole shift that's happened. You know, abortion is glorified as this wonderful form of birth control now in Europe and in America. And there's new pills coming out that, you know, render you sterile. And it seemed as such a wonderful advancement in society.
Yeah.
And they're marketing it to kids as young as, you know, 8, 9 years old. And that's the direction that the social engineers are pushing. When I say social engineers, I'm talking about government agencies, and there's government employees within those agencies, and we're talking about people who are being contracted to provide information to kids, the state funding and promoting certain organizations that are family planning organizations, and promoting cross-gender cultures and value systems at younger and younger ages with kids in school.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. You don't see this stuff all over the world. This is exclusive. This is exclusive to Europe and North America. It hasn't penetrated the rest of the world. But that's the direction that the people who, let's say, own this planet would like to take it. And it's an ugly, ugly picture of the future. And I've seen it with my own eyes firsthand. It is the most horrific thing. I've, you know, seen horrific things in my life, but I've never seen anything as horrific like a 26, 27-year-old woman crying on the street outside of an abortion clinic. You know,
wow.
You know, I've never seen nothing is as horrific as that.
Peace.
Okay,
yep.
And that is a minute-by-minute occurrence now in the Western society, and it's the most unbelievable phenomenon. And I think a lot of people have missed this because it just kind of seems to be happening, and no one really looks at it and talks about it. But that is the center of society, the family unit, a woman's ability to bear children. People getting married, having kids, looking after the kids, sending them to school. That is the basis of our society.
Well, if there's one thing we know, it's that we procreate and we die. You know, it's like one of the most fundamental, what we have in our existence, one of the most fundamental aspects of it. And I think it's also, Patrick, for that very reason that the social engineers have wanted to hijack this and control this and regulate it. They want to make it obsolete, but they also it goes deeper than that, beyond all the chemicals that are neutering people, of course.
They want to mechanize it.
Yeah.
They see it and they want to see it perform almost like a factory. Okay.
Yeah.
And who is in charge of the factory? It's a technocrat.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not an elected representative who's a man of the people or a woman of the people. It's a technocrat. And we, in our political classes, we are breeding technocrats right now to fill exactly those roles in society. And it's happening right now. And, you know, there's a lot of bite back against it around definitely in parts of Africa, in South America, in definitely in the Middle East. There's a lot of bite back against this. Because they come in there with their millions of dollars in programs, and NGOs are coming in selling all this stuff. I mean, Common Purpose from the UK, which is a kind of, it's a covert sort of political, it's like the political collectivist version of the Freemasonry. You don't have to declare your membership in public. They're sending in their teams into Libya while the country is vulnerable. Okay, and in order to put in their Common Purpose structures there of change and change management, and it's basically aggressive change, and it's about pushing out future leaders, and it's also about it's pushing out faith and religion as we know it, and replacing that with other things, atheistic sort of ways of thought, or communist.
Well, it's exactly. It's a scientific, the scientific dictatorship. It's you know, belief in nothing greater, nothing higher, and we have all the answers. It is, you know, strictly tied to the scientific model. Well, I mean, you do have a burst of New Ageism in there as well, occasionally, but nonetheless, you're right. I mean, it's a very cold and sterile view of what the human being is and you know what it needs and everything else. It reminds me more and more of like computer games like The Sims. It's all, we're comprised of this character. We just have these various bars that just need to be filled to the right level to be content. And it's like Huxley talked about, you know, we will come to a point where people will be content with their servitude. They will be happy to be in this, you know, mechanized system, this bubble that's been set up for us. I mean, THX 1138, it's not far off, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's people will not just be, it's not so much that they'll be happy with their servitude. What they'll be relieved that the state won't interfere with their little joys or their little vices. That's what I see the culture has, how it's developed in the UK. They've flooded the market with cheap ecstasy and cheap amphetamines. And during the period of 2000 to probably 2010, that sort of 10-year period, the markets was flooded with very cheap drugs. Okay. Mm. And so the amount of users mushroomed geometrically. And what they will allow kids and young people and some old people as well to take their drugs in certain fenced in environments. In the UK, there are festivals all throughout the summer, 500 festivals, and they allow the drug taking within the fenced environment where they're sort of in there like Palestinians for 3 days. And then allow them in the nightclubs as well. And that's their little bit of joy. Okay. So
it's a steam valve, you know, to kind of let out the pressure. Okay. Go be, you know, be immersed in debauchery and, you know, so-called, you know, freedom or whatever that, you know, that small amount that they do have. Right.
Yes. You could take away every single right and privilege or whatever that they have outside of those walls, and they will not protest as long as they're allowed to have their vices in private or be able to play their Xbox or whatever while they're in their living room or whatever. Yeah. That is their little bit of pleasure, you know. Please leave me alone, state. Let me have that at least, and I'll be a good subservient, you know, but just don't take away those two, three things. And that's really how it's been reduced to. You know, the world is closed in for a lot of people to that degree. Yeah. That is all they've got. There's no careers. There's no jobs. There's no social justice. There's no real political progress. What's left is, yes, I can go into a dark room between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. with 400 or 500 other people, and I can swallow a pill and have absolute euphoria for the next 5 hours.
Well, it sets the stage, Patrick, for what is next in the plan for social control, which is to this move into our transhuman future, virtual reality, life 2.0, where basically your satisfaction will be in a virtual space. That's where you be able to do things, explore things, maybe even travel and stuff like that. It will literally be like a, you know, the cubicle that you're in, but your senses will be you know, overloaded with the what the digital world has to offer. That's what I see anyway coming.
Yes, that's what Ray Kurzweil, the famous computer programmer and a futurist author, who's a science fiction writer, that's what he was talking about this past week. That potentially we could have access to millions of virtual worlds and open up millions of new nodes in our brain. And in fact, even when we leave this physical body, we'll be able to download our consciousness and experience millions, perhaps billions, of other virtual worlds and realities. Now, that might seem like a really wonderful thing to some people, but I can't even sit down and watch the television, so you're not going to get me into a virtual world, you know.
Well, I've got the Matrix, you know, but people wanted that when the Avatar was released, and that, you know, people had like depression symptoms afterwards, allegedly, because they couldn't be in that world or whatever. Remember that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you take away, oh my goodness, I have to tell you, Henrik, Are you familiar with the TED Talks?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was privy to watch TED Global a couple weeks ago. And, you know, what we're talking about right now, they're pushing a lot of these ideas through TED. And they've gathered all the really intelligent, nice people and have them caged into this little sort of, to me, it looks like a corporate cult. But they're promoting a certain set of ideas through there. Obviously, the global warming, the climate change, that's just on the surface. But what they're really promoting through TED, through a lot of these speakers, is the sort of glorification of like the iPhone, the smartphone for one, as your new companion. And also, they're glorifying and promoting, in a way, cybernetic transhumanism. And I saw this with a couple of speakers in a row. And they were talking about the iPhone like it was the greatest technological invention ever, and that DARPA had provided some of the seed funding for it, and how wonderful that was, and therefore DARPA should be part owner of Apple. But you know, I got to thinking that everyone had their, and everyone in the TED Talk before the speakers began, they all had their iPhones out. Everyone's fingers were on the screen doing what they do on the screen of the iPhone. And then they watch the speakers, and they're talking about the iPhone, and they're just surrounded by this iPhone. and I'm feeling around in my pocket, and I pull my phone out, and I've got a little Nokia, which is a tiny little thing, but I love it because I only have to charge it once a week, and it's brilliant. It doesn't have any sort of smartphone features at all, and I've missed the iPhone revolution completely. And I'm very much active online. I'm on social networks and I'm on all this stuff, but I don't have an iPhone. And I probably have more time to spend in the real world than most people with iPhones do, because I don't have one. But then I thought to myself, did this idea of technology and progress, how wonderful and how fantastic these smartphones are, and because of these smartphones, they need to now, IBM's come out with the next generation of chip to take on the huge data requirements to make this iPhone perform in better and better ways. And I thought to myself, if the iPhone or the smartphone, and to have all these expensive microwave, potentially dangerous relay stations for data transfer, you know, using us essentially as a human guinea pig population to test it out, the effects of it over the next few years. But anyway, if the iPhone had come out, Henrik, in 2020 rather than in 2008 or whenever it came out, would the world be that much of a different place? I mean, having yourself hooked up on a handset, is it that much of an advantage for mankind? Is it really revolutionary, or is it just another layer of convenience that has been sped along the timeline to this point in history, when in fact it doesn't really have a whole lot of bearing in terms of benefit on the human race?
Absolutely, you're right, and we should always put that in perspective and see how things are, how, you know, the human race is transforming, and a certain of these technologies are literally viral. There's like a virus that spreads with them. And at the same time, you know, kind of coupled with that, just what you said as well, for me it's a lot about, okay, but what do you do with it? What, you know, what kind of content do you do? Are you learning with it? Are you going forward, etc.? But I think we all could do good from just disconnecting from it now and then and actually get some perspective. But that's another level, I feel, of the maybe unintentional side effect, but the fact that we never get this perspective. It's always connectivity. It's always there. It's never peace and quiet, never one moment of being disconnected for many people these days.
Yeah. I get withdrawal. I mean, I used to get withdrawal symptoms if I wasn't on my website posting or whatever, but that's a different sort of...
At least there's a positive drive, because you have a drive there. You have an intention of, you know, spreading information, good information, proper, getting the truth out. You know, that's a healthy drive on top of all of this, you know. But if you're on there, you know, looking at what do people do online? Look at porn, and they, you know, look at gossip and, you know, sports results and everything else. Just, you know, it's entertainment. It's just occupying the mind, basically.
Yeah, I mean, look at the big corporations like, you know, we have Apple and obviously the social networks that are playing a big role in our lives. We're talking about Facebook. There's a whole virtual community there. And of course, Google has large portions of this online activity wired into its network. But Microsoft goes very much under the radar these days, but they're very active in the background as far as infrastructural stuff. Now, if you're talking about the let's talk about the surveillance state for a minute. A lot of people are not aware that Microsoft did a joint venture with the NYPD, the New York Police Department, okay? And they've designed this thing, which they call, the nickname of it's Gotham City. But essentially what it is it's a high-tech security system, which is multi-angle surveillance and analyzing the data in real time. It's called the Domain Awareness System. It's created by Microsoft, and it even says that this system can predict a criminal event before it happens through the use of complex analysis and algorithms and so forth.
Really?
And
Wow.
this is in play right now in New York City. It's implemented right now. Okay, so
Interesting.
this is working as we speak, and it's very dark in its scope. And if you look at Microsoft, I'll give you an example. Microsoft have got their hands dirty on many occasions. You know the Stuxnet virus.
Yeah.
I know how that was delivered. They couldn't. It wasn't delivered by a thumb drive. It wasn't delivered by a hack. Basically, it was delivered through the pipeline through Microsoft updates into the computers in an Iranian nuclear facility. Okay,
Yeah.
down the Microsoft pipeline. Okay, a lot of people don't know that.
It's just funny. I don't want to interrupt you, but pick up on that, but it's just funny to think about that these, global or like international enemies and different countries or conglomerates, but they're all still like tied to Microsoft Windows, all of them. It's kind of hilarious to me in a way. But pick up where you were, where you're leaving off there.
No, absolutely. And that's an incredible amount of power that corporation has.
That's right.
They've got the keys to almost every, well, not almost every, but say 80% of the global desktop, 90% maybe of the global desktop computers,
Yeah.
Microsoft have the keys, the backdoor keys into. And so, what are the people in Microsoft, what sort of deals are they doing with the intelligence agencies? What sort of deals are they doing with the NSA? Well, we know they're doing deals. They sit together at Bilderberg every year. Craig Mundie has been at Bilderberg. He's the head of Microsoft Strategic Strategies. He's been there for the last 6 or 7 years, and he's in there with Eric Schmidt. He's in there with all the top
Google guys,
U.S.
yeah.
people. Yeah, so I mean, they sit down and they're aware of each other's business, and they have a level of familiarity at the highest levels
Yep.
in those organizations between the corporates and the government. And that, by definition, is global fascism.
That's
Okay?
right. So when they talk about cybersecurity, as allegedly was a big topic on this year's Bilderberg conference, what are they really talking about there, do you think?
They're talking about erecting their digital rings of steel, cordoning off various markets. One thing I know they were definitely talking about at Bilderberg, because Bilderberg was really interesting. This was the year that the Bilderberg Group came out in public. They released their guest list to the London Telegraph in advance. That had never been done before in terms of releasing the guest list to the mainstream media. It had always been supplied through a leak in Bilderberg to people like Jim Tucker from American Free Press, who sadly passed away in
Yeah,
April.
yeah.
But this was Bilderberg's coming out year, and it was very interesting. It happened in London. I opted out this year. I didn't go. I decided to stay in Beirut. But I did have an opportunity to go, and I didn't want to go because I sensed that it would be a media circus in the wrong ways, and I didn't want to be there. Let's put it that way. But all the attention in Bilderberg this year was on obviously Alex Jones. being there.
Yep.
And very little of the people there were concerned with what was actually going on inside. But a few very resourceful people from the UK column and a little outfit called Liberty Tactics in the UK, they went, as soon as the hotel was open to the public, they went in and started looking around and accidentally wandered into a banqueting suite where they hadn't taken down all the presentation materials. And lo and behold, it was a presentation by the Thomson Reuters to the Bilderberg Group. And the quote, the title of this presentation was Unleashing the Power of the Unified Global Financial Markets. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to remember, Thomson Reuters was integrally involved in the LIBOR scandal. And the head British Banking Association head and the Barclays head, his name is Marcus Agius, and he's a Bilderberger. And he was there this year. Okay. And Thomson's used to report the LIBOR rate. Okay. So they were part of that chain of the LIBOR scandal. Of course, they're on the innocent side, supposedly, right?
Yeah.
They've now done the same thing with the global currency markets. We've discovered through Bloomberg reports a few weeks ago that the global currency markets are as rigged as the lending interest rates with regards to the LIBOR scandal, and Thomson Reuters is at the center of that as well. Okay. So there we discovered a piece of the Bilderberg agenda going in with the global tax regime. We took a lot of photos of some of the people coming in and out, and we got a piece of the agenda after the Bilderberg meeting, which is a hell of a great job by that team in the UK. And I have to tip my hat to them for that, because they've given us a glimpse into a few different things that, you know, allowing us to see what's behind the scenes there. So I thought that was fantastic, and they do not get enough credit from the masses.
It was Malcolm Massey, Neil Foster. I think we've had Neil with us before, if that's the same Neil Foster.
Yes, that's Neil. Neil from Sovereign Independence.
That's right. And then Mark Anderson as well.
And Mark Anderson from AFP. So, but that's a really important one. And, you know, people look at Thomson Reuters. It's an everyday brand. The brand is everywhere. And one would not question if they were involved in any of these international financial scandals, which are basically scams, in order to rig the game, basically, so that those who have a lot of money to gamble can make big returns, okay? And then, you know, obviously, the small players get wiped out. It's exactly the same as, you know, as some gambling dens I've been to. So, but there you go.
Game is rigged. The house always wins. Yeah, that's the score, and taking out all the competition, you know, again, it's like people should be concerned with the equality of the quality should be there is, you know, the infrastructure that exists for everyone to equally have the ability to, you know, to make money or to work for themselves and everything else, as opposed to at least directly what people have or don't have, and then, you know, according to those rules, trying to level the playing field, because again, as we know, a lot of things are being in the liberal agenda, it's being used with terminology. It's targeting solely your emotions. It's about equality and things that sound good. But many of these people who talk like that are some of the biggest predators out there. And they use this lingo because it lowers people's guards. It makes them not think right. And it's a very clever strategy of how they get people to just go along with an agenda, which is completely antithetical to what most people would actually go along with in the beginning.
Absolutely. You know, that's how they roll out these problem reaction solution scenarios that they roll out is someone's going to have a solution at the end that seems to be more equitable for everybody in general, when in fact what it is, it is very much about killing the competition. It's about eliminating choice. So there's fewer and fewer choices. The U.S. housing market and the banking collapse is a perfect example. The big banks were able to garner trillions in free money from the government in terms of bailouts, but a lot of press coverage was not given to all the small banks that were caught up in this contagion and who collapsed. So these are sort of local mortgage brokers, local banks in regional and sub-regional areas, they're gone, many of them. And also, you can look at the same pattern in agriculture with farming, the same exact thing happening, where only the big corporate farmers can afford to operate.
Yeah.
So it's a running theme across multiple sectors. The farming thing is huge. Obviously, you have companies like Monsanto who are providing the seeds on one side and the chemicals that germinate those seeds on the other in the form of fertilizer. And also they have the legal muscle to enforce patent regulations and legislation and so forth. So small farmers can't afford to be in business. They can't take on the big guys. And so they come and they buy them out. So we're seeing smaller and smaller number of small farmers, mom and pop farmers. And the state is coming in to legislate growing your own food in a very aggressive way, especially in America and in Europe right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable what is going on, and it's excellent that we can, of course, be here and talk about it in detail, Patrick. There is one point I think we should end on. I want to get some of your comments on this, another item that's been in the news recently. Michael Hastings, the Rolling Stones reporter, died at 33 years old in what's being said to be a car crash, pretty much. He was driving his 2013 Mercedes C25 or C250 rather, and he has an interesting past, of course, Michael Hastings, because he was part of the he wrote that article called The Runaway General about McChrystal, and basically managed to get him socked because of that. He was getting ready to release something. Allegedly, before he died in the car crash, he had sent some emails about being worried that he was tracked basically by the FBI. But one of the most interesting clues that came up most recently, I was going to read a little bit about this here from the Huffington Post, said, according to a prominent security analyst, technology exists that could have allowed someone to hack his car, Michael Hastings' car. Former U.S. National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism, Richard Clark, told the Huffington Post that what is known about the single vehicle crash is consistent with a car cyber attack, Clark said. There's reason to believe that intelligence agencies for major powers, including the United States, know how to remotely seize control of a car. And it, of course, goes on from there and kind of details some of this story for it. But were you aware of some of Michael Hastings' work, Patrick? And do you think it's possible that he was taken out for the very reasons of him being very critical of, again, more of the surveillance that was going on of Americans and, the whole story, basically, that this is how they're running the show now, by just assassinating and taking out people like... what was the other oppositional to CISPA and SOPA? Aaron Schwartz. Thank you. Exactly. Same scenario, possibly a different, accident, quote unquote, that happened there. But again, interesting. People are being taken out.
Yeah, that's a plausible speculative analysis in terms of remote control of the car. A lot of people believe that's how Princess Diana died in the tunnel in Paris. It was that car was commandeered and ran into the side of the road. And with regards to Hastings, he's working for the Rolling Stone, and it was incredibly embarrassing. I mean, McChrystal was a big guy. Okay, this wasn't a small guy, and He was a big guy in terms of the military industrial complex. Probably McChrystal had, it probably still has anyway, a lot of lucrative future opportunities because of his position and the people he knows and the experience he has. And that's kind of a little bit been railroaded a bit by some of the exposure regarding some of the stuff Hastings did on him. Drunken conversations at bars and so forth. Now, I'm sure Michael Hastings made a few enemies there, but more than likely, if Hastings was in danger, it would be over something that he knew, because we have a federal government in America that has a track record of targeting media, journalists, press, to get information, to find out who their sources are. And we've already learned that out in the open with the AP scandal. And the AP scandal in America, a lot of people missed that one. The Department of Justice went in and grabbing phone records between this time and that time, and who knows what else. They're looking for information that the press had, probably confidential sources. In particular, it was about a Yemeni bomb cell, a terrorist bomb cell, that the AP had a story on, and they had a source. Now, it turns out that this Yemeni bomber cell, John Brennan, who's being nominated as the new director of the CIA, was forced to admit in front of Congress that that Yemeni bombing cell that AP was looking into, the key guy, and maybe this is what AP found out, and Brennan had to spill it to let it out, the key guy, the central, the trigger man, the bomber, was a U.S. informant who they groomed for that position. That was the central story with the AP Department of Justice intimidation of the press and spying on the press, okay?
Yeah.
So we have a federal government in America that has a track record of hounding press and journalists and either jailing them or spying on them and stealing their information, okay? So what did Michael Hastings have? What did Hastings have that he hasn't released yet? What did Hastings know? And he probably knew a fair bit, considering the sort of level of stuff he was covering. Now, the Rolling Stone is still it's still a kind of a corporate entity. I don't know who actually owns them, but I would say that they might be in the kind of corporate octopus somewhere with a bigger company. I'm not sure if they're completely independent or not, but I'm sure you can look that up. But, you know, Hastings driving the latest Mercedes on 100 or 200 grand a year or whatever. I'm not sure what they pay these guys. But if he did have enemies, when you're in that, when you're being paid by the company and you're part of the machine and you're digging into the power pit a little bit too deep, well then, because you're getting all the benefits, you're seen as fair game by your enemies. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the difference between Michael Hastings and some blogger who's doing it in, you know, in his spare time, but might be breaking an equally big story. They tend to be ignored by the establishment. But Michael Hastings clearly was not being ignored. He was being watched. He was being tracked. But did you discover anything in any of your reading of this story that you thought you could draw a really clear line, a clear thread to say that, yeah, he was definitely in the middle of something big? Because I didn't look that closely into it in terms of, I didn't read everything. I just read
A
bit about it.
There is more, exactly. There's more I need to look into as well to try to get a hint of what he was onto and what possibly could have been some of the, you know, new stuff that he was working on. But I know that he was outspoken recently, of course, in the media and allegedly working on something that was connected, I think, in some manner or capacity to the surveillance state, basically. But definitely need to do more on that. But there's other cases as well, as you know, Patrick, in history where this happens. Journalists like Gary Webb, you know, who wrote for San Jose Mercury News. Hunter S. Thompson was speculated. He was working on something on 9/11. He got, shot twice, I think, in the head with a shotgun or something like that. They said he killed himself. Vince Foster, the whole, you know, Clinton story and everything else. It's like, it's on repeat, many of these stories.
Yeah. No, you're definitely, your life's in danger in certain parts of, if you're very high profile. And also, you know, look at Aaron Schwartz. I mean, this kid was no slouch.
No,
he was a genius, actually, and he's one of the new generation of really, really savvy .com innovators, software engineers, and also. He had a bit of a social justice streak running through him in terms of, he understood that the internet might be in danger of being controlled, regulated, or shut down in certain ways. And Aaron Schwartz, one would look at Aaron Schwartz and young people would emulate his success and certainly listen to anything he had to say. And he was he came across to me as a very nice young man. And seems to come from a good family, and just really smart, and he's a great innovator. That's why he's successful. I mean, he's one of the founders of Reddit.
Yeah, that's right.
Along with one of the guys who wrote the original RSS software, I think.
Hastings was involved in Reddit too, I think.
No, really?
Yeah, one second now. Let me look that up.
That's interesting.
Yeah, Michael Hastings. He was one of the founders basically of Reddit as well.
Oh, you just gave me ammunition for my next article.
Yeah, I mean, it's something's going on here. Wait a minute. I don't jump ahead of myself here. Or was it BuzzFeed? Let's see here. I don't want to give you the wrong story here, so let me see here.
Well, I'll check it out. But so, you know, Hastings was involved in some big stuff online as well.
Yeah.
Very talented guy, obviously. Very smart guy, very savvy. Maybe had a social justice streak running through him as well, like Aaron Schwartz did.
Yeah.
Certainly Aaron Schwartz's parents don't think that he killed himself. And he was being spied on, and he was being targeted by the DOJ. That's on record. So, you know, yeah. Mea culpa. Who's going to take credit for killing somebody like that? Nobody. It's going to be up to us to be able to dig and find out the truth one day, hopefully.
Yeah.
But we do right now have people in power that are dirty, that play dirty, and are gaming the system in their favor, and also using their positions of authority to crush dissent. And this is something that used to be reserved exclusively, in our minds anyway, to places like Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union and Red China. And of course, it's always been happening in our societies under the radar as such. But now the difference is, Henrik, it's happening in public.
Yeah.
Now they're being quite bullshit about it and very unapologetic about it. And that's the difference. That is the difference in the paradigm between the past and now. That's the liberals will say, oh, it's, you know, there's always been government corruption, and oh, people are always corrupt, and it's just, you know, it's a byproduct of being in a free society. You know, but I'm telling you, the paradigm is not the same as it was 20 years ago. It's very different now. People are very upfront about taking sides on this, and of course, the state, the government, the corporations, they don't care about the rights of, you know, the other thing with the NSA surveillance thing is they're doing this in the cooperation with the big players like Google and Facebook are handing the stuff over. And also, they're selling the data to the government, and the government's collecting data and selling it back to the Googles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We outlined that on 21st Century Wire in an article. Clearly, it's a fact. So they're all involved in this kind of trade, if you will, of data and information. And so it's happening out in the open, Henrik, and that's the difference in what's happening today. And that's the thing that's probably most shocking. My question is, what are people going to do about it? How hard will people push back? Are a lot of people even aware of the seriousness of the situation right now in terms of, you know, kind of, The police state, the Orwellian state, has come out of the closet. It's in the open now. It's not being done in the Rockefeller think tanks behind closed doors anymore, the RAND Corporation or whatever. It's now being done out in public in full view, in total complicit and compliance between the corporations and the government,
yeah,
rolling stuff out. So what will the public push back against this at some point? Or is this system so pernicious and so massive in its scope that it can't be stopped? I'm a believer that it's still the corporate side you can't do a whole lot about, but on the political side there's still a chance to do something. But it's very, very difficult right now.
Yeah, it is. They're doing live data tests, it seems, if they have supercomputers running everything else at their disposal. They're making a lot of the experimentation, almost, it feels like. That's, you know, when I see the uprisings, as we talked about in the beginning, of the you know, using the social networks and what happened in Egypt and Libya and everything else, it seems like a live, they're doing it in real time, if I can put it in that way. So it's very interesting. And also, by the way, before I take that step in the wrong direction there, Michael Hastings was involved in BuzzFeed. He was a reporter for them, so I confused that with Reddit for some reason. So no need to follow on that trail, Patrick.
Yeah. So very interesting, though. We'll keep an eye out on the Hastings. Obviously, if you discover anything interesting, do send it my way.
Will do. Yeah.
But yeah, just also, you know, great job with Red Ice. Your website's looking great, and you guys just seem to have a steady flow of excellent guests. So I think it's a great operation you guys are running there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Patrick. And we appreciate your work, of course, because it's essential. We have geniuses like you who can come on the show and break down some of these global events for us. So we couldn't do it without you, Patrick. Why don't we end with you giving out your websites again and let us know if there's any way that people can support you or get involved in your work in any way, or hook you up with on social networks or whatever, something like that.
Yeah, I think if anyone's listening, if you want to do us a big favor, go to our 21st Century Wire Facebook page and hit like. And there's a great news feed that we're doing there on a daily basis. And these are stories that you're not going to see on Infowars.com or any other sites. We try to do different stuff and get the real incisive angles on things. So 21stCenturyWire.com is our website, our YouTube channel, 21st Century Wire TV. And I think we're going to be hopefully doing some good stuff in the coming months. We've hit a trajectory on the upward trajectory, and we want to keep going there. And down the road, I would like to publish a magazine and have that available to our members or whatever we decide to do. But I'm a big believer that we got to get back into print and get back into things we can put in our hands. So that's something that I might be a venture I might be going into in the fall or the winter. But in the meantime, you're going to see some great reports from the Middle East. We're going to have a film on Cyprus coming out. Might be part of a series of the European economic collapse, where we're going to travel to different countries. I'm hoping that project's going to take some life in the next few months. But so there's plenty of stuff to report on, Henrik. There's plenty of things going on.
That's absolutely right. We'll keep an eye on the website, of course, in the meantime, 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you, Patrick Henningsen, for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Henrik.
All right, that's our program for today. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with more in just a few days. Keep an eye on RedIceCreations.com for more news and stories from around the world. Thank you for your support, for your membership with us, both listening and learning, and of course also enabling us to continue to analyze, investigate, and report on the most fascinating and important stories. Much more is coming. We'll talk to you in a few. Take care.